You're listening to Casual Swim.
Amazing to have you here. Just want to ask you some questions about your illustrious history and a little bit about your creative approach, and then like your album, the first one in 10 years. So yeah, I guess going back to the very start, like what was your first into music? And I've heard other interviews where you talk about Northern Soul and all that kind of stuff, but was there any like tipping point that really got you to be like, okay, I really want to invest some time and this is, I'm signing up for this for life type thing?
Yeah, I guess, you're probably aware, and I expect some listeners and stuff are aware that for a long period of time in my early youth, I was sort of growing up around music quite a lot. My parents, as you say, were kind of heavily into Northern Soul and going to their own parties and stuff like that. And I always had a fascination with music. Didn't matter what sort of music it was, I was always recording stuff off the radio and trying to like pause the tape before the presenter spoke and making my own like mixtapes and stuff like that. But I mean, the real kind of turning point in terms of me wanting to do it as a career would have probably been in my early teens, sort of 14, 15 years old, when I first got my first set of turntables and was kind of getting into nightclubs with fake IDs and kind of seeing people perform. And, you know, getting dazzled by the lights and lasers and listening to all sorts of music across the spectrum of dance music and feeling that I wanted to be a part of that, you know.
From coming from kind of Northern Soul origins of your parents, how did that progress into electronic music? Like, was it electronic straight away, or was there elements of like punk culture? Because it seems like genres are shit, but people say that, you know, your music's quite influenced with a wide range of backgrounds, including like punk and kind of, I guess, more guitar led music. Is that true? Or
yeah, I'd say so. I mean, in my early years, I mean, I've obviously, you have quite a broad mix of friends when you're younger, and everyone's got different tastes, everyone's from different backgrounds, and it all goes into a bit of a melting pot of music, really. Like at the same time that I was listening to, I guess, early rave, really, like, you know, I used to get tape packs from rave events, and people used to buy them from record shops, and you'd have like 8 tapes in a pack, and it'd be all the different DJs on that event. They would get sort of swapped around between friends and start listening to rave music that way. But on the same sort of period of time as that, I was also big into kind of all the Brit pop stuff, so the Oasis and Blur, and kind of, you know, even then that opened me up to start listening to stuff like the Beatles, the Doors, and also kind of 80s culture stuff as well. So I was listening to my older uncles and stuff were always playing like Prince and David Bowie and kind of 80s synth pop and stuff, and I think that the synth side of the 80s music kind of got me more hooked on the electronic stuff that I was listening to at the time. But as I say, it's all around the same sort of time. I was quite a mix of music, so I was listening to Britpop, I was listening to 80s stuff, 90s stuff, as well as the rave stuff as well. So it all kind of together somehow found its way into it being electronic music for me.
You touched upon it before, but what was rave culture like back in the day?
Just a lot different. I mean, you know, you had a lot of the music you hear now, a lot of the ravey stuff now, is obviously a tip to the 90s stuff, and almost trying to sound like that. In terms of using the same synths and the same production techniques. But back then, yeah, there's no phones, it was a bit more intense, and kind of, you know, a lot of love in the air for the music and stuff. But I sort of first was dubbing and sort of 98, 99 period. So I was listening to like, that sort of turn of the century trance stuff, as well as hard house and hardcore breakbeat, drum and bass. It was all kind of fresh at that time. You know, now you hear it all now. You write like rave, say sort of hardcore never dies. There's loads of people playing ravey stuff now, but just shows it's now spanned sort of 3 decades and isn't really going anywhere, which is wicked.
Amazing. What kind of artists were around that period that you were listening to, or that were kind of blowing up, or that were kind of leading the scene in a way?
So with all the ravey stuff, I was kind of listening to Carl Cox a lot, where he was coming out of like when he used to play kind of hardcore stuff like that. DJs like Slipmat and they were sort of icons, and obviously that brought me into the more poppy, I guess, crossover stuff, which was still ravey, like with the Prodigy and Enjoy and 808 State, that kind of music really. And then I also was listening to the sort of trancier side of things and the hard house stuff with DJs like Tony DeVee and you know, like Ferry Corsten, Richie Horton, Jeff Mills. And that was kind of, you know, all around that sort of period, really. So it was quite diverse back then. I think nowadays you get a lot of parties that are quite genre specific, or kind of, I guess, like a click of a sound. But in the sort of late 90s going into the early 2000s, you could go to a club night and the DJ that's following the one before could be completely different sound, completely different music taste, and it would be on the same bill. You don't necessarily get that so much anymore. I guess at festivals you do a bit, but in club culture it's quite unheard of now. It's all very a bit more formulaic to the sort of genre that they play,
for sure. And do you think that's a positive or a negative, or is it just kind of different?
Yeah, I guess it's just different. I think it's just the way it's gone. I think we all now are so focused quite heavily, especially for events, on brands over kind of DJs. So you tend to get an event that's a branded event, and then, you know, from that brand you, I guess, get accustomed to the sound that event portrays, really. You know, whether it's particular event that's got DJs that play for that brand or whatever, but you seem to associate now styles of music with brands as well as DJs. So I think that's the difference nowadays.
Good segue to the next question, which is around, like, how has electronic music progressed over the past 20 years? And, you know, you were nodding to it going from like a bill with lots of different types of sounds to more of a night where it's based on a label or a sound. But is there anything else that comes to your top of the mind around, like, transition? It's a big question.
I guess progression from electronic music nowadays is, yeah, I mean, the scene's changed in terms of the way that events are delivered, as you say, with, like, you know, we're just talking about it with brands and stuff like that. But also, yeah, so the accessibility of dance music and electronic music's a lot better than it used to be. You know, back in the days, buying a synth would cost a hell of a lot of money that you couldn't afford it, you know. But nowadays, with digital software and digital DJing platforms, digital synth, and the whole accessibility of people getting into dance music now has broadened quite a lot, which has definitely helped progression. I mean, I wouldn't have said it was kind of an insular, kind of not difficult to infiltrate kind of scene, but certainly now it's a lot more broader and people can kind of get into it a lot easier, I'd say. So I certainly think that sort of approach is a good way of looking at things. But in production, I quite like the naivety sometimes. I always say the best thing, you know, sort of, that you can do as a producer or a musician is to not be influenced necessarily by the way things are done or the older sort of methods of doing stuff, because I think that spurs your creativity a bit more when you're going into it with a bit sort of wet behind the ears and a bit naive, because that's when new sounds are created and new styles and kind of new ways of doing things, because you haven't been influenced by listening to maybe how a normal track is put together, you know. Yeah. But I do think there is something in having some of that previous knowledge before, but certainly maybe close off in terms of influence and try and just create something that you feel sounds cool.
Amazing. Getting on a little bit about your creative approach, like, how does Alan Fitzpatrick make music? Is it a linear, structured process, or is it quite impromptu?
I'm sort of all over the place when writing music, especially as my studio's at home. Sometimes I might be in the studio 2 hours just doing mucking about on stuff, and sometimes I might be in there all day, but ultimately you're just being creative. I don't necessarily have a structure to say, right, I'm going to start with my beats and then I'm going to start with a melody and then I'm going to try and work a bass line into it, stuff like that. Sometimes it can be like that if the track feels that that's the way it's going, or if I've come into the studio with an idea and I know, right, I want to use a hook that does this and I want it to do this and this, then it might be a bit more structured. But ultimately it's kind of, yeah, wherever it takes me. I might end up playing on a synth and then starting with like the lead synth line because I've got that first sort of thing. So I quite like to keep it random and seeing what happens, because there, when some of the tracks you do, you kind of go in a completely different direction to what you may have sat down and thought you were going to do at the start of the day, because it's just that sort of happened that way. And I think that's when some magic can happen sometimes.
So talking about your tracks in particular, what do we want? Wait, hold on. What do we, wait,
we do what we want.
Yeah, we do what, that's a bit of a tongue twister. We do what we want. Like, can you tell us about the production to that? Cause I love that track. It's pretty, for me, it's quite different. It's just like, yeah, talking about the kind of punk origin, it feels really like quite raw and a bit punky.
Yeah. I mean, I think ultimately I had the idea of the kind of hook. So that I kind of put that together first and then kind of worked backwards on that track and built around that. But yeah, that track, when it came out, at the time that track came out, like techno was kind of certainly with all the drum code stuff I was doing, and that was in a period where it was quite big drops and you know, vocal hits and building up kind of big moments. But there, I felt like I was missing some tracks with like big kind of ravey hooks. So that's how that one came about, really. And I started it sort of in the middle of the track and worked outwards on that one, if you like, sort of with the hook, and then kind of created everything else around it. But yeah, that, and then that subsequently became the sort of tagline for my record label, We Are the Brave, and that was the first single.
Amazing. I guess talking about your production process, and like in particular the hardware you use, what is your studio, or what does your rig look like? That's the first question. And the second is, if you're a DJ sitting in the UK or anywhere around the world, what would be your advice in terms of their hardware setup to get started type thing?
So I have built up my hardware over the years, really. But my base DAW is Reason. I do everything on Reason. And then I've got multiple hardware stuff. So like my bass synthesizer, I've got a Korg Minotaur, my Roland TR-909. I've got various Electron bits. I've got a machine drum and an analog rhythm. Synth wise, I've got my Moog Sub 37, my Korg Minilog, Roland Juno 60, Roland SH-101, Moog Grandmother, Udo Super 6, Roland Alpha Juno 2. So like, all of these are kind of classic, kind of some vintage and some new. Like my newest synth is my Udo Super 6, which is insane. But I mean, I don't necessarily think you need all those things. I mean, I like to have the hardware because I've grown up listening to some record, like loads of huge records that are made using these pieces of equipment, and I'm in a position where I can afford to get those now. So as a sort of, you know, kind of audio junkie collector, I want those bits of kit. But you can ultimately, you can still do just as good with using what's in the box, really, in terms of like just being software based, you know.
Do you think a piece of hardware goes a long way in terms of the production process, as opposed to just doing everything via software on a screen?
For me it does. It's more creative to be able to be more hands-on, you know. I can make, if I'm hitting record and I've got like something going in the on Reason, like a loop that I'm working on, and I'm using a hardware synth, like I can feel the pressure I'm putting on the keys, I can feel how much I'm pushing on the filter, and I can, you know, I'm physically doing it and getting that sound by being in control of it. I suppose it's in the same way as when you're DJing or live performing, you're a lot more hands-on, which feels a bit more connected to the music. Like, it, instead of drawing in automation or just using your mouse and clicking on something that you need, and you're twisting it to bring, I don't know, bring a filter into dry or wet or whatever, or a different frequency. It feels different when you're actually doing it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely does. Cool. I guess talking about the state of play of current electronic music, what's your take on what's happening in the electronic world and your brutal honesty? Like, yeah, do you think, and I guess this is going towards the interrelationship between pop culture and underground culture, like, are you conscious of what's happening firstly on like Beatport charts, and then also like what's happening in the pop world? Or are you in your own lane just doing your thing, or is it all connected?
To a degree, I try and sort of stay in my own lane and just focus on what I'm doing. But yeah, there's certainly sort of, I guess I'm almost like old is new kind of approach at the moment in terms of music. There's a lot of music that comes out that sounds like it could have been made 20 years ago, or there's a lot of, you know, like younger DJs coming through that are playing records that are potentially 20 years old as a new record, because it's the first time they've had the opportunity to sort of hear that music. So I think you always get that kind of regurgitation of cycle of sound, you know. But in terms of like pop and underground, it's very difficult, because I think underground is a funny word. People use it a lot, but ultimately, if it's underground, me and you don't know about it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah.
If it's proper underground, we don't know about it, because if you know about, like, even when you're looking at venues like or you know, nights like that, Berghain and stuff like that. Like Berghain, obviously, is a resident there. I love it. It's one of my favourite places to go. But in terms of people to say that's underground music, well, it's the most famous club in the world.
There's books written about and whatnot. So yeah.
Yeah, like crazy. I don't know how it's underground if it's the most famous place in the world. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's, yeah.
I think there's a culture like around these sort of things where people think, yeah, this, like, I mean, there's some pop music that you hear which you can kind of say, oh, that sounds like edgy and cool and kind of bizarre, but it's still pop music. I just think people like what they like. Do you know what I mean? That's why I sort of try and sort of just keep doing what I'm doing and try not to focus too much on everything else. But I do think that pop culture and underground culture influence each other, even if it's in fashion sense or styles or kind of the way people portray themselves. I think they're both linked, you know. Art, fashion, pop and underground all seem to be linked in some strange creative way, really.
Yeah, that's interesting. Going on, I guess, talking about the pop and so-called underground movements, well, I guess you have people like Paul Wolford, who's doing stuff with like Diplo, and they're kind of, you know, branching out into the pop world. Like, yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately if the music's good, go for it. I think this is what I mean. I think there's too much put nowadays on should and shouldn'ts. I mean, ultimately, if Paul Wolford's going to release a track on into the top 40 or the world kind of pop charts with Diplo, and then it's still got his kind of special request stuff where he's playing in some of the best underground or perceived as underground clubs in the world, then all power to him. I mean, I think if the music's good, then go for it. I honestly think putting labels and kind of almost restraints on where and when and what sort of music you can release can really stunt people's creativity. I like to get in the studio and, well, you know, when I'm going to sit down and go, right, I'm going to make something underground here. I'm going to make something kind of more mainstream. Mm. Just whatever happens, happens. And I think that's a much more freer approach. So if you want to do something that's kind of going into the, you know, more mainstream, or you want to do something that's more underground, ultimately that all that is you being creative, really.
Yeah, that's a really good way of looking at it, actually. Talking about you being a bit of a UK pioneer in the electronic / techno scene, do you think there is like something that's quintessentially UK? Is there such a thing as like UK techno, UK? I imagine there's a little bit with like German techno. It kind of sounds like, if you were to put it into a kind of a big holistic bucket, there are definitely like some kind of similarities with that sound. Is there such thing as UK techno? Does it exist, or is it?
I guess to a degree. I mean, a lot of it's probably more just on the fact that UK DJs that play techno are grouped into a UK techno sort of bucket. But ultimately, you know, the sound is, techno is probably the most widest spectrum of sound that's grouped into one genre, really, which, I mean, I hate genres anyway, but I mean, obviously techno is one of those. But I think it can all be grouped together. I don't really segregate sort of UK techno with sort of, say, German techno or industrial techno or whatever. I mean, there's elements that are different, but if anything, maybe UK techno's got a bit more touch of a raviness to it, maybe a bit more head, like touch to sort of nostalgic early UK hardcore rave in some element, whereas your kind of German techno maybe a bit more edged down the kind of modular sounding industrial way of production. So there's a bit of a kind of sound difference, but I wouldn't say there's enough to be able to segregate techno in between territories, really.
Fair enough. I guess, like, with you, are you like boys with some of the other UK like producers, I guess, like Denson Peaker?
All know each other.
What's it like between you guys? Like, do you guys have a WhatsApp group, and are you guys like chatting all the time, or is it more like around making music, or what does that look like?
I think a lot of us chat quite a lot. We've all got each other's numbers. We all sort of converse quite regularly, but most of the time it's, you know, you're seeing each other on the road and catching up that way, and you know, sometimes we're making music together, but ultimately a lot of it is your sort of touring buddies, you know, see each other a lot on the road. And there's a few artists that I speak to, yeah, whether it be kind of messaging and stuff like that, but ultimately I think a lot of that was happening as well during the lockdown when no one was touring, so we were all kind of chatting and sharing music that way. But yeah, now I think where everyone's kind of hectic on the road again, we're all bumping into each other in service stations or airports backstage and stuff.
Amazing. I guess, like, is there much interrelationship between you guys, like that kind of crew, and I guess like the drum and bass world and the big beat? Like, I know you just made a track with High Contrast. How did that come about? Obviously he's like amazing, but was that an organic process, or have you been trying to work with him for a while and he's trying to work with you, or like, yeah, how did that High Contrast collab come about?
Yeah, I think sort of the same theory really, where we bump into each other at like festival backstages or on tour, and we actually had discussed about doing some music together like years and years ago in one of those environments. And then with lockdown, we kind of realized that we had the time on our hands to be able to maybe reconnect and do something where we weren't heavily touring or working on our own projects. So it sort of came about from that, really. When we've been friends for a long time, we've discussed making music together. We always thought it'd be a massive curveball that people would be like, would never picture the two of us doing music together, which was exciting. And then, during kind of the fact that we were just locked in our houses, in our studios, we just were sending files back and forth, and we made it happen, basically.
Incredible. So can you tell us about that track and like how working with someone like that, was it your beat production and his melodies, or was it vice versa? Or yeah, can we break down that track a little bit?
Yeah, so a lot of the beats were Lincoln's High Contrast. I had done a lot of the melodies on that track on my Korg. I was using a Korg synthesizer, and then adding arpeggiators over it with my Roland. So a lot of the kind of basis of the melodies and stuff on the track came from me. And I think I originally did that bass line, which we then changed the notes off, but the actual bass line that you hear was created here. And then Link was with sort of beats and the kind of ravey samples over the top, as well as the vocal and stuff. He was using some old vintage sampler to do all that stuff, and kind of old tape delay. I think he used a lot of kind of production methods from his recent album. That was quite cool. It's just great to be able to work with people that are from a totally different genre, because you're whether it's kind of production techniques or style or just a different approach to stuff, it's always nice to work with people from other ends of the spectrum. And luckily for me, it's kind of cool to work with he's a drum and bass legend, he's like an absolute pioneer of that sound and has been at the top of his game for as long as I can remember.
Yeah, for sure. Were you guys conscious about the world in that you put the music out, or do you guys not care about it? Like, do you care about reviews and critics and all that kind of stuff, or do you guys
know? No, I don't think I've really ever read a review. Just ignore it, and not because I don't want to know, but I'm like, if I didn't think the track was good enough to be released, it wouldn't have been out, you wouldn't have heard it. And ultimately for me, once the music is out anyway, it's like it's in the public domain, it's then your music, it's not mine anymore. If I've released a track, it's no longer mine. It then becomes, the consumer's. So people can sort of think what they want about it, really, by that point, because I've already detached myself from it being mine and then giving it to whoever wants the track, But we didn't have any kind of issue on putting it out. If anything, I'm more excited to drop collaborations that make people kind of look twice, and certainly that track with High Contrast is something that someone could read in a magazine and then probably go back and read it again and go like, what, those two together? is cool for me. I like that, rather than it being an obvious collaboration.
This was the first album in 10 years, Machine Therapy. Like, 10 years is a long time. What was the delay, or was it just...
I've always been writing music. So I've been, even though that album has basically been, it's not like it's been 10 years in the making. It's just that it happens to be 10 years since I did an album. The last album was on Drum Code. And basically, I think, because I've always been releasing music, and if you go back on my catalogue from, say, now, and go back 10 years to the previous album, there's music out nearly every month and there's lots going on. And I think because I was doing touring so much and writing lots of EPs, and some of those EPs were kind of 6-7 track EPs, so I guess they're kind of mini albums.
Yeah,
but ultimately I just throughout the lockdown period, I thought it was time to actually specifically set myself a target of writing an album as opposed to just a collection of tunes. And then, you know, I had the time to do it. And I think that's why that album also, it's not really a club album. It's a bit more emotive. It's a bit more of a kind of headphone Spotify type album, because it wasn't written for nightclubs. At that point, nightclubs didn't exist. Mm. They were closed and we didn't know if they'd ever open. So I was writing music that just kind of wanted to explore my, you know, different creative sides and work with people that I'd never really get the opportunity to work with. But yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, so it also just shows you how quickly time flies, because when I it was only when I was completed it and kind of thought about maybe getting someone involved to release it that I was like, yes, yeah, it's been 10 years since I did a sort of yeah. long play, right?
Also, I guess Jonna Deep and like kind of the Deep House label, how did that come about, working with those guys? And yeah, like, are you still kind of rolling with Drum Code, or is this like you're just kind of finding a new home for some of your stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still heavily involved with Drum Code. I've got some more music coming with them at some point as well. I just think with this album, where it was a lot more emotive, there was a lot more kind of melody, deeper music on there and stuff. And Juna seemed like a perfect outlet for it. They do great things with some really cool artists, and they've got they're a massive in that sort of genre, really. So I wanted to give it to someone that could look after it properly and also.
Amazing. So is there a particular environment that you think that album should be listened to? Like, is that like a after the club, or before you go to the club, or when you're like going for a run, or when you're going for a walk? Do you think about the context?
Ultimately, I think I've tried to make it work in all of those situations. So it's kind of a bit of something for everyone, hopefully. The approach was to basically have it exactly as you said. There's a bit of everything in there, really. So I wanted it to be consumed in all of those environments.
So what advice would you give young DJs and producers just starting off, like, with all your vast experience in the game, like, is there any like lessons that you can kind of share with the listeners on, yeah, I guess your kind of life lessons in a way?
Yeah, I guess there's a few. I mean, ultimately, I would say don't rush. You know, there's no, sadly, for kind of young artists or any aspiring producer or DJ, there isn't, despite what people might think, there isn't any shortcuts. You know, you need to be patient on what you're doing and find the right home for your music or the right club for you to play at. You know, don't rush into things, because unfortunately things can't be undone. If you make a bad decision or whatever, it's there now. So I would say don't rush. You've got to graft hard for sure, like really, really work on what you're doing and make sure that you're somehow standing out from other people, because everything's so accessible nowadays that, you know, for a couple of £100, you can get a setup that effectively could get you performing and stuff. So make sure that you've got something about you that's different to anyone else. And then I would say don't be influenced by what's currently there. You know, I think somehow try and be unique in what you're doing, which is easier said than done. But there's always new artists popping up and people that excite people even now. So there's obviously ways of being creative, but definitely try and be unique, because, you know, the world doesn't just need another run-of-the-mill techno DJ. We want or whatever DJ from whatever genre, to try and do something that's going to make you stand out from the crowd.
For sure. Okay, so last question. It's a big one. I ask like lots. I ask every artist this, and it's a bit somber, but like, how does Alan Fitzpatrick want his legacy to be remembered?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's 1,000 answers for that one. But yeah, ultimately, I guess, this is a nice bloke that provided memories for people in terms of, you know, hopefully my music will live on way longer than I will, and people will still get some sort of joy out of what we've created as a brand and as a label and me as an artist, really. I mean, it's a bit kind of narcissistic to say, you know, yeah, I want to be perceived as a legend and this and that. But I mean, ultimately, just hopefully that whatever I've created and whatever I've done, it sort of touches people in a way that they have some positive experience with it.